You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Clarence Thomas has been serving in the Supreme Court since the fall of 1991, and throughout those 16 years, his voting record has angered civil rights leaders and liberal Democrats while being hailed by people on the right. President George W. Bush has said that he's one of his two favorite justices, the other being the equally conservative Antonin Scalia. A new book, Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas, by Washington Post reporters Kevin Merida and Michael A. Fletcher, explores who Justice Thomas is and why he's been such a controversial figure among African Americans. It's published by Doubleday. I'm very pleased it has brought Kevin Merida and Michael A. Fletcher to my show today. Hello.
Thank you, Larry.
Kevin, didn't this book emerge out of an article you both wrote for the 10th anniversary of Justice Thomas's confirmation hearings?
Yes, for the 10th anniversary, and we were actually late producing that. We started in 2001, and just as a side fact, we were in Pinpoint, Georgia, his hometown, in Savannah, doing reporting 9/11. And on the very day that we were scheduled to interview Clarence Thomas's mother was when the terrorist attacks occurred, and needless to say, that interview didn't go forward. We were told she was very worried about her son, and everything changed. We didn't publish the magazine piece until a year later, and we got a book contract in 2003. So we're just kind of living with this subject for the last 6 years.
And do you think that it's important that the both of you are African Americans who might understand Justice Thomas's complex feelings about race, that you wrote this book, that you took this look at him?
Yeah, I like to think so. There have been a number of books about Clarence Thomas through the years. He's been kind of an object of fascination on the court. But no other book has really taken a look closely at kind of Thomas through the racial prism. And I thought we were well positioned to do that. And I think that's the big issue, particularly in the African-American community when it comes to Clarence Thomas. I mean, here's a guy, the highest ranking black official in the country, but yet he's an outcast in much of black America. And we thought that was an interesting conundrum that he faces. And we wanted to, you know, delve into that.
And Kevin, you've said, I think race plays a large part in most black people's lives. I think the myth was that race wasn't important to him, but we found out it was.
Yeah, it's very important to him. He's very racially conscious. He's very class conscious. You know, he talks about, you know, his upbringing continues to kind of sear him, I believe. When he was growing up, as raised by his grandfather, who was an illiterate man, self-made man, learned how to read himself and owned a business, fuel, oil, and wood, ice. He felt that his grandfather was looked down at by some of the leading lights in the black community, even though he's a successful black man. He's always been linked color and consciousness, which was something that was prevalent in the South. I mean, Clarence Thomas is a dark-skinned man and grew up being teased, he said. He said he was called on the playgrounds America's Blackest Child. And there were, you know, social groups that that some of the other kids belonged to. And he's always felt kind of there's been a separation to his life and others who have done well.
Is that why he's often talked about growing up in poverty in Pinpoint, Georgia, when in fact he grew up in middle class home, even if his grandfather was illiterate, in Savannah, Georgia?
Yeah, I think he likes the poverty narrative. I mean, I think that it helps. You know, even when he was at Yale Law School, I mean, he gravitated toward the couple of students whose parents were janitors and other working class, so he's always related to that. I mean, as you pointed out, Leonard, his house was burned down when he was 6 years old.
And by his brother, wasn't
well,
it? He's playing with matches?
Yes, he's playing with matches, and the fire, it separated the family. His sister stayed behind, and he and his brother went to live with his mother and then with the grandfather and were, you know, brought up through the Catholic school system.
So he went to private schools on top of it.
Yes.
All. Now, Michael, you mentioned that he is upset that he's viewed as an Uncle Tom or a sellout on the Supreme Court. But most blacks supported him against Anita Hill's accusations during the confirmation hearings. Has it simply changed because of the way he's voted, or has something else happened?
Well, I think that's been part of it. That's been the biggest part of it. As you point out, and people forget this now, when he was ascended to the court, most black people did believe him and not Anita Hill.
And that high-tech lynching remark really was very powerful at the time.
Right, exactly. He put the Judiciary Committee on its heels with that comment. You had this all-white panel that was just paralyzed by Clarence Thomas invoking race in that powerful way. But yet, when he got to the court, there was a series of cases right at the very beginning of his tenure that I think kind of sealed kind of the opinion of him or changed the opinion in black America, at least. It was the famous Keith Hudson case, the prisoner from Louisiana, who had been beaten by prison guards and sued. And his case made it all the way to the Supreme Court, and he was charging cruel and unusual punishment. But Clarence Thomas, the only black member of the court, wrote a dissent against this man, against Mr. Hudson, saying that he was beaten, that's terrible, but it's not cruel and unusual punishment. And that kind of set the tone for Clarence Thomas's jurisprudence. Early in your introduction, you said he and Scalia are the two most conservative. Increasingly, people are saying Clarence Thomas is more conservative than Antonin Scalia.
And he, in the Myers and in, no, what was the case where he's the only person who decided that he was not going to vote to free to reverse a decision because of race? Even Scalia went along with it. Yeah. Now I'm trying to remember what that was, but it'll come up to me in a little while.
But what you see it across the board, Leonard, you know, with his jurisprudence, the states' rights stuff, Clarence Thomas is the biggest supporter of those kinds of things. He would undo a lot of federal regulations when it comes to environmental and civil rights matters. So he's very much a staunch conservative.
And he has been opposed to affirmative action programs from the start, despite the fact that some people have pointed out that he was a recipient of all sorts of benefits as a result of affirmative
action. That's one of the great conundrums of his career. If you look at his rise, particularly through the Reagan administration, he came to Capitol Hill in 1979 as a junior Senate aide. And 12 short years later, he's on the Supreme Court. And every step along the way, race played a part in his ascension. But now on the court, he's been a staunch opponent of affirmative action, and that leaves many civil rights people and others just puzzled.
My guests are Kevin Merida and Michael A. Fletcher. Their book, Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. It is published by Doubleday. So he went to Catholic school. Was this his decision, or was this something that his grandfather decided on?
Well, his grandfather had been part of a Baptist church, but the Catholic Church played a big role in black communities and still does, and it was the education that was considerably better than the public education during Jim Crow that really drew many blacks to the school system. The Franciscan nuns actually helped teach Myers Anderson to read, and they were very instrumental in Thomas's upbringing. In fact, his grandfather had hoped that his son, you know, he looked at him as a son. He had hoped that Clarence Thomas would become Savannah's first black priest. And so he left and went into the minor seminary during his high school years, in which he was the only African-American to graduate. And that was his first real experience in outside the black community and in this place, the Isle of Hope, outside Savannah, and that was his first experience with racism.
And then he went to Immaculate Conception Seminary in Missouri to become a priest, and left, he said, because the seminarians weren't compassionate about the death of Martin Luther King Jr. So I don't know. The ironies start piling up as we start looking at the early years, because he also then says that his favorite author was Richard Wright.
Yes,
and that he said just as Richard Wright's Bigger Thomas had been consumed by the conflagration of prejudices, stereotypes, and circumstances beyond his control and understanding, I felt myself being similarly consumed. I stood at the brink of a great abyss of anger, frustration, and animosity. You would have thought this guy would have been to the left of Thurgood Marshall.
Yeah, I think that's one of the puzzling things for many people. I mean, It's something of an irony that he abhors victimhood, and yet he's become probably one of the most successful victims in the country. And he continuously has flipped back and forth between those two images. I mean, Bigger Thomas is one he relates to. In fact, there was an article written in Reason magazine some years afterwards about the confirmation hearings. He said of all the critiques of him, the one written by in Reason was the one that he related to most because it linked him to the Bigger Thomas character. And he sees himself as someone who has been unfairly maligned. And, you know, at the same time, many people look at him and wonder, you know, he's been extraordinarily successful and wonder why he can't kind of embrace that success.
But I just remembered the case that I was trying to think of. Here we have this guy who was a would-be priest who leaves the seminary because Reverend Martin Luther King's death isn't respected, and then flirts with Malcolm X's radicalism. He buys every speech that Malcolm ever recorded. And he becomes the lone justice to cast a vote against granting a stay of execution to a Texas death row inmate named Thomas Miller L. on the grounds that the Dallas prosecutors systematically excluded black jurors in his trial. And that even Antonin Scalia voted differently than he did.
It's one of the interesting things about Clarence Thomas. He's become the most sort of vigilant justice when it comes to race. I mean, he wants no racial sorting at all. If you look at his jurisprudence, and this is what partially made him a hero to the right. Clarence Thomas says that we should never look at race ever in any kind of government function and something like that. And when it comes to the death penalty, Clarence Thomas is a strong supporter because of his originalist type of jurisprudence. He said when the Constitution was written, the death penalty was contemplated, and thus it's constitutional. He's, you know, other justices, we've narrowed the death penalty over the years for the mentally retarded, for the young. Clarence Thomas wouldn't do that.
Well, if we become racially colorblind, that would be great. But how do you deal with it in a world where the rest of the country isn't always racially colorblind?
You're asking the question that many people ask of Clarence Thomas. And, you know, his answer is almost to say that as a justice, that's really not my problem to solve. He just says that the Constitution...
The law is the law?
The law is the law is the law. He once described being a justice as sometimes watching someone drowning 20 feet below you, but having only a 10-foot rope. So he thinks that he has a limited role and, as you know, can't solve society's problems. Take those to the legislatures around the country. Take those to the Congress. As a justice, all he does is interpret the Constitution.
I think that, you know, also, Leonard, that he finds it hard to kind of grapple with his place in juxtaposition to his positions. I mean, here is somebody who clearly has benefited from race at every standpoint, and he believes that affirmative action, which of course has become kind of one of the kind of touchstone issues, particularly among black Americans, he believes it undermines black achievement. And so in a sense, it's kind of, you know, he has to kind of cancel out his own life in order to really hold that position. And it's a very hard place for him to be.
But he's not the only black man who takes that position.
Well, he's not. But, you know, as Colin Powell and others say, that it's really somebody else's problem what other people think of us. There are many successful African-Americans who don't worry and fret and wring their hands as much over how others perceive them. I had an interesting conversation with James Horton, who's an eminent historian at George Washington University, African-American, and we were just discussing this. He says, you know, when he thinks of Clarence Thomas's position, he says, you know, you think that Babe Ruth was, you know, thinking he was less of a slugger and worried about what people thought of him as a slugger because he didn't have to face Satchel Paige every day, or Bob Cousy thinks he's less of a great point guard because he didn't play against the great black players. And so it's really part of it is the psychology of Clarence Thomas, that he knows that he's in a situation where people are looking at his achievement. And that started as soon as President Bush nominated him and said he was the best qualified candidate for the court, which was one that was roundly scrutinized.
Well, obviously, nobody questioned whether Thurgood Marshall got there because of affirmative action, but their past, their histories have been quite different. We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll look at how Clarence Thomas went from being an admirer of Malcolm X, a guy who wore berets in college that were reminiscent of the Black Panther Party to becoming one of the most conservative members of the Washington establishment. My guests are Kevin Merida, associate editor at the Washington Post, and Michael A. Fletcher, who covers the White House for the Washington Post. They have collaborated on a book called Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. It is published by Doubleday.
It pains me deeply, or more deeply than any of you can imagine, to be perceived by so many members of my race as doing them harm. All the sacrifice, all the long hours of preparation were to help, not to hurt.
Clarence Thomas talking about his feelings about being called an Uncle Tom. My guests are Kevin Merida and Michael A. Fletcher, who's collaborated on a book called Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. It's published by Doubleday. And you suggest here for a man who talks about being colorblind in the court that he's probably more conscious of race than an awful lot of other people, we might very well expect to be conscious of race. So do you think that it works as a kind of like a counter, has an opposite effect? If they're going to see me that way, I'm going to do the opposite? Or is there something deeper here?
You know, I think it's some of that, but also something deeper. Clarence Thomas, as you point out, has been a racially conscious guy going all the way back. We were talking earlier about the slights he endured at seminary. And it's funny, you would talk, in reporting the book, we talked to a lot of people who went to school with Clarence Thomas, and many of them were oblivious to this. They didn't realize Clarence Thomas had been wounded the way he says he had been wounded. So that's kind of interesting, because he would always have this kind of like bearing of being a content guy, one of the bunch, but actually he always saw himself as the black guy among this group. And he went to college at Holy Cross after leaving his seminary. People are surprised to know he was a founding member of the Black Student Union. And there he participated in student protests, once helped lead a walkout of black students from Holy Cross, ended up going to Yale. And that's where his views began to shift when he went to Yale Law School.
But he says that when he was at Yale, he was so far to the left in his thinking that he thought George McGovern was a conservative.
Voted for George McGovern in 1972.
Yeah. So how did the shift occur?
I think a lot of it had to do with his class consciousness. Kevin had mentioned when he went to Yale, he was among 10 black students at Yale, but he really connected with the two other working class guys. And he looked at the other black students as being kind of the children of the middle class, and he didn't connect with them as well. And he felt that they looked down on him. And at the same time, he felt that white students at Yale were questioning his presence at the school, and so he kind of felt squeezed from both sides. And affirmative action became kind of the big issue for him. You know, he sort of felt like if there was no affirmative action, the white kids wouldn't have, they wouldn't have standing to question my presence here. And that began the early beginnings of his move to the right. Then he couldn't get a job out of Yale, ended up working for Republican Attorney General in Missouri, John Danforth, who went on to the Senate and, of course, became Clarence Thomas's big sponsor.
So within 10 years of voting for George McGovern, he winds up being appointed a chairman of the EEOC by President Reagan. But he also has called his own sister a welfare queen. She didn't have the advantage he had of moving in with the grandfather. But that would suggest he can be very hard.
Well, yeah, I mean, he can be very harsh. I mean, he got a lot of criticism for that, not only nationally, but by some of his intimates. I know that Prince Jackson, a bishop in Savannah, who did the eulogy for his grandfather, even today, says that he deserved his criticism, and that was very harsh. His sister, of course, tells a more complex story than Thomas told the nation in December 1980 when he gave that interview to Juan Williams about his sister, in which he said that, she singled her out as an example of the debilitating effects of welfare and said that she couldn't wait to, the mailman to bring her check. Well, the sister, As she tells the story, you know, she was taking care of elderly relatives back in Pinpoint, oftentimes working two jobs. She's picking crabs. She bought hand-me-down clothes for her kids. You know, she was on welfare for a period of about 8 years, we were had determined. But at the time of the comments, she says she was out of off welfare. And there has been a strained relationship between the sister and the brother. It goes back. A lot of it has to do with just their lives are really, really diverged, and they really don't have much in common and much to talk about. Even she says, other than just kind of how's the weather and how are things. And she lives a very simple life as a cook at one of the oldest boys' homes in the country.
Well, it's not surprising that they've grown so far apart. He was originally offered a position in Ronald Reagan's administration as the Department of Education's Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights, and he was insulted because he said he was offered it only because he was black. He also, I gather, keeps all of his rejection letters from law schools in an envelope. So it's kind of... Well, I keep on finding it odd that he has voted the way he has on the Supreme Court, coming from all of these feelings of slights.
Well, you know, a lot of what you refer to, Leonard, are exactly the kind of things that many black activists, politicians, and others talked about at the time of the confirmation hearings. There were a great many people willing to give him the benefit of the doubt, and that helped from a political strategy standpoint. It really kind of helped to kind of isolate and neutralize black opposition. As Mike mentioned earlier, the majority of blacks supported Clarence Thomas's nomination, even after the showdown with Anita Hill and her sexual harassment allegations. He went to the NAACP in a private meeting. You know, we obtained the minutes of that meeting, and he said that he didn't, it wasn't true that he was opposed to affirmative action. He went through kind of, you know, list by list of all of the things that were said about him. You know, he said he wasn't, he thought that there were some benefits to some of the Great Society programs. He said that the remarks about the sister were mischaracterized, and he really kind of wowed the NAACP. They ended up giving him an endorsement after much debate.
So is he just lying, or do you think that he was sincere in it through his own prism?
I tell you, when you talk to NAACP leaders now, they think they were lied to. They say Clarence Thomas, you know, whatever his image is, he's a pretty skilled politician, and he's been able to sort of say things to the right audiences to get where he needs to get to. You know, the same way about the civil rights establishment generally. He had famously said back when he was at EEOC that this, NAACP and other civil rights groups do nothing but bitch and bitch, you know, whine and whine and moan and moan. But yet, before, in his confirmation hearings, he would extol civil rights groups, say he stands on the shoulders of civil rights leaders who came before him. But yet, in the privacy of his chambers, he'll talk badly about these people, you know, with friends. So it's interesting that he's able to shift ground as he sees necessary.
My guests are Kevin Merida and Michael A. Fletcher of The Washington Post. They have collaborated on a book called Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas. It's published by Doubleday. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Doesn't Clarence Thomas say that Thomas Sowell's book, Race and Economics, changed his life? When did he read that? How soon after he voted for George McGovern?
Yeah, I tell you, well, he and Sowell have an interesting kind of history. Thomas says he was first given a Thomas Sowell book at Yale, and he immediately threw it in the trash. But yet when he went to Missouri in his first job in the Danforth's office, in the Attorney General's office, he was shown a Wall Street Journal article about Thomas Sowell's book, got the book, read it, and felt, as he said, I think he said it was like pouring water on hot sand or something. He really just consumed this book. And he was so taken by this that he took a two-hour drive from Jefferson City to St. Louis to meet Thomas Sowell, who was there speaking at Washington University in St. Louis. And the two struck up a friendship that endures today. And Thomas Sowell, as you know, is a very conservative economist who talks a lot about, he'll say something like, racism is immutable, but the challenge is, how do you overcome racism? He said certain cultural traits play a role in that, certain habits that people develop play a role in that, and that's what he focuses on. And I think in Soul, Thomas saw kind of an underpinning for some conservative instincts he was feeling all along. And then he also connected that to his grandfather's example. And he looked back at his grandfather and said, you know, what made him make it? How did he, an illiterate man, you know, kind of carve out a middle class life, at least by Jim Crow standards in the South?
He pulled himself up by his own bootstraps.
Exactly. And that's, I think that's where Clarence Thomas came out on that.
You know, speaking of Soul, Leonard, there's an interesting piece of correspondence in Harry Blackman's papers, which we perused quite significantly. And Soul sent Harry Blackman a letter, a very tough, harsh, critical letter because of Blackman's support of the death penalty. And somehow Blackman got it and obviously knew that Soul and Thomas were close. And he didn't really know Soul. And he sent this correspondence on to Justice Thomas and really embarrassed him. And because, you know, his colleague has been insulted, and he said he would speak to Thomas Sowell. And of course, maybe he did or didn't. We weren't able to determine. But of course, they're still very close friends, and both of them are very tough critics. I mean, they can be very harsh to people who don't agree with their point of view.
Another writer he admires is Ayn Rand.
Yeah, that's back in his EEOC days when he probably was more of a libertarian. You know, it's interesting. Thomas started...
He and Alan Greenspan.
exactly. And that's right. He used to, as a matter of fact, even now, he has his new clerks. He would have them out to his house and show them the film Fountainhead, you know, the Ayn Rand classic. So he was a strict libertarian and kind of moved even, you know, away from that into being just what you can only describe as a conservative, which is an interesting word, because if Clarence Thomas had his way, things wouldn't be conserved in this country. A lot of the law would change dramatically. That's the irony.
He also made his staffers watch the 1949 version of Ayn Rand's best-selling book, The Fountainhead.
Yes.
So they became Gary Cooper fans, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's going pretty far. Now, on the other hand, you point out that he would like to see himself as just a regular guy, and he and his wife cruise on their condo, in their condo on wheels, as they call it, and go to Walmarts and other places where he is likely to meet just the everyday Joes of America, and he goes incognito.
Yeah, his 40-foot motor coach he might set up in a parking lot, as you mentioned, in Walmart, and sip some lemonade, have his cap on. There's a group from Pinpoint that comes up to Virginia every summer, and it's his closest childhood friend, Abe Famble. His mom comes, sometimes his sister, a cousin, and they go out and they you know, usually tour some historic sites, maybe go to Gettysburg or Luray Caverns or in the Shenandoah Valley. And he enjoys these trips on the open road. I mean, initially when he bought his Prevost, his wife was wondering, well, you know, what is this? He had to convince her that this was a good investment. And it really kind of reflects something about what he likes. He likes to be away from crowds in some sense. He likes to kind of have a certain amount of privacy that he finds difficult to achieve as a Supreme Court justice.
Well, how relaxed is he with strangers? Because he refuses to engage in the normal interview, the sort of thing that we're doing, without having an awful lot of control over it.
Yeah, it's again one of the, you know, there are many contradictions with Clarence Thomas, and I think that's one of the hallmarks of our book, is that we continue to kind of find those. But he, you know, as you point out, I mean, he, you know, doesn't want to go and mix it up. I mean, Charles Freed of Harvard Law School, a friend of his, former Solicitor General, has been trying to get him to Harvard Law for years and years, and he won't come because Freed just believes he knows he'll be criticized, and he doesn't want to face that kind of critique.
Well, how much is Clarence Thomas a reflection of the contradictions of African-American society? For example, if you go to a black church, you're likely to hear people preaching against affirmative action programs, against same-sex marriages, for three strikes laws.
No, you're totally correct. I mean, and it's one of the points that he makes. I mean, I think there's a kind of a myth about the African-American population is much more conservative and much more diverse than maybe the popular media gives credit for. You know, there have long been these kind of debates and discussions internally within the black community. So in some sense, it's a puzzlement why Justice Thomas, who would be a great articulator of his point of view, won't go out and debate them. But I think that he's endured a lot of protest and a lot of hostility, and I think he just doesn't want to engage that kind of virulent reaction to some of his points of view.
And aren't many critics of affirmative action within the black community critical because it doesn't really help poor blacks? It helps middle-class blacks get into better schools. So poor blacks aren't even likely to be considered at Yale.
Well, you know, I think people who say that forget the role affirmative action played in integrating police departments, the middle management ranks of civil service, you know, employment around this country. But having said that, I think you're right, and that's Clarence Thomas's argument. He, you know, and again, it goes back to Yale. He says affirmative action, you know, why do these children of lawyers need affirmative action? You know, and this is only something that's going to help our critics, you know, sort of give them ammunition to fire at us to say that we, you know, we wouldn't be here otherwise. So Clarence Thomas sees affirmative action as something for the elite, even though I think that's a narrow vision of affirmative action.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us today. I've been speaking with Michael A. Fletcher and Kevin Merida, who are both with The Washington Post. Mr. Merida is associate editor at the paper and has been a national political reporter for its and a feature writer for the Style section for how many years now?
Wow, I've been since Bill Clinton was elected president. So it's been about 14 years.
And Michael A. Fletcher covers the White House for the Washington Post, where he's been a reporter since 1995, the middle of the Clinton administration. Right. Their book, Supreme Discomfort, The Divided Soul of Clarence Thomas, is published by Doubleday. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Yeah. Thank you. Our pleasure. Leonard. Thank you so much.